Good afternoon and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and as we tell you each week, this conversation can include you if you'd like to join us. Our number is 941-3689 if you call us from Oahu, and from the neighbor islands, it's 877-941-3689, and that number also works if you're calling us from the mainland or someplace else where you're listening to the live stream. Last December, frustrated school systems across the country hailed the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act that replaced the federal oversight-heavy No Child Left Behind with the more state-directed Every Student Succeeds Act. Since then, states, including Hawaii, have been grappling with the transition. School year 2016-17, soon to begin, is seen as the bridge. And that's leading many parents to wonder what to expect and where Hawaii will go as it develops its ESSA plan due next spring. Today, we'll look at how Hawaii's education stakeholders are beginning to work on the ideas that surfaced during Governor Ige's recent ESSA summit and how the state's Strive High Performance System aligns with the ESSA requirements. If this is the chance to better localize education and make it more responsive to individual communities, will Hawaii be able to successfully do it? Around the table tonight are Daryl Galera, the head of the governor's ESSA team and a retired high school principal, Amy Peruso, the secretary-treasurer of the Hawaii Teachers Association and State Teachers Association, and also an ESSA team member, and Jim Shawn, the director of the Education Policy Institute at the University of Hawaii. And you too. Again, our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Welcome to all of you.
Hello. Yeah.
Good afternoon.
Now, normally summertime might be seen as downtime for some, but certainly not this year with trying to figure out where the state is going to go from here. Daryl, I want to start with you and pick up from the conversation that we had about a week ago after the governor's summit and talk a little more about what came out of that summit in terms of ideas and direction that stakeholders were proposing, and also who was there and who really wasn't there.
Okay, well, we reported that the governor's ESSA team changed from 19 members to 1,019 members. And so we had close to 1,000 people at the summit at the Hawaii Convention Center. we had all stakeholder groups, teachers, students, parents, community members, principals, Department of Education, leadership.
What about lawmakers?
There are a few lawmakers, many from higher education, many from the business community. So we had a wide range of all of our community members there. As far as what came out of the summit, we were able to hear from our national leaders in education, including Senator Lamar Alexander, who's the architect of the ESSA. We heard from our state leaders, our superintendent, our board chair, our governor. And most importantly, we heard from the voices of our people in Hawaii in terms of what they feel, what their thinking is, and what their feedback and input is into a new blueprint for a new education system for Hawaii.
It's been well over 6 months since the ESSA came into being and people began to get their minds around it, but there still seems to be some real confusion about what it allows for and what it doesn't, and that, you know, situations like testing of children is still very much aligned with the ESSA.
Yes. I believe it's a matter of your perspective in terms of what you believe is provided for or not. In terms of the law itself, there are clear compliance things that have to be done, including testing is still required. How you decide to do the testing is now an option for the states. You no longer need to be select from either the Smarter Balance testing or the PARC testing. A state can now make its choice and can decide to do testing totally different, portfolio assessments, or do it some other kinds of assessments. So, again, it's a perspective you take in terms of what's possible. Our governor has taken the lead and has come up with a vision that not only will we take full advantage of the opportunities of ESSA, but we'll also take advantage of this huge opportunity to really revisit and redefine public education in Hawaii.
Amy Peruso,
yes.
As you represent the HSTA and also as you sit on the ESSA team. One of the other issues was how teachers will be assessed.
So teacher evaluation under ESSA has shifted. So there are no longer any federal requirements that student learning outcomes are linked at all to teacher evaluation.
In other words, student test scores has been decoupled from it?
Not just test scores. So as a result of that shift, there has been a partial change in how teachers are evaluated. So there has been delinkage of the student test scores, as you mentioned, from teacher evaluation. But the student learning objectives, the SLOs, they're not, they're still part of the teaching evaluation, and that's not federally required. So there is, we're not shifting as much as the federal law allows us to in terms of teacher evaluation.
Jim Sean, you have been watching this play out for the last 6-7 months and looking at how this is being crafted and some of the ideas that are being brought out. The idea that, you know, this could be a game changer if we wanted it to be, or it could be just a slight impulse as long as it meets federal requirements and allows Hawaii to continue to do what it has been doing. How does this sync with, for example, the Strive High performance system?
Well, you know, the original sin of No Child Left Behind was high-stake testing in just two subjects, right, almost every year. The impulse of principals, schools, all kinds of people to teach to the test was not required by No Child Left Behind. We drifted into it. It became almost human nature. Oh, yes. What about social studies? What about the arts? What about history? What about anything else we were not focusing on? We talked about STEM these days, but STEM is a combination of subjects. Science wasn't even part of that, right? So what I look at is that No Child Left Behind morphed and drifted in its mission to include teacher evaluations and Common Core, and they pushed back on that. But Hawaii's orientation towards top-down, and I know Daryl's organization is very much looking at school empowerment, this top-down notion focused on two tests, a single state plan for everybody, that's still there, right? And so it's very important for the governor's group and the Education Institute and others to not just say, okay, we're now in compliance with this new neat law, but to push it beyond that, that even a single state plan or assessment structure have multiple choice. You can do this. You can do that. We have not taken seriously things like kids who do great in the science fair, and we give them zero credit. They do History Day, zero credit. They make the Youth Symphony, zero credit. All these things that we talk about, the whole child, you know, development and learning, we have not in the DOE even taken the first baby step to say, hey, you do that, we'll give you credit. And the UH doesn't do it either, you know. So I think we have a lot of interesting challenges and barriers. The new law itself, to me, is barely a change from the waiver we already got. It's going to take...
And to explain that, because we had a waiver with No Child Left Behind.
That's right. We had a waiver, and they gave us some more flexibility and how do you choose whether or not you're successful, whether it's reducing gap groups and things like that. Data collection is probably even doubled down in this new law, more data. So the DOE is racing to figure out how we collect this data, keep the test going, yada, yada, right? But the idea of hope that came through, the hope is a school that looks and feels and operates differently. That is not going to come naturally. We have to do it with a lot of public input and a lot of pushback and understanding the barriers to that within our current system.
Daryl Galera, before we move off this a bit, but what Jim Sean was alluding to is the fact that Strive High does meet the requirements, or mostly meets the requirements of the ESSA. But his point is, why stop there? Why not look at some real models of education that would be radically different, that would have very different ways of measuring student achievement? And we've seen some of those schools pop up, you know, High Tech High in San Diego, other schools like that, different types of ways of learning that don't boil down, you know, a subject to what can be taught in 42-minute increments, and then off you go to someplace else. And so the real question that seems to be asked about this point in Hawaii's educational history is, are we going to take advantage of this? Are we going to be able to push this to a limit that says we're going to do it very differently? We're going to do something that's going to be quite responsive to the communities and what those impulses are within them to make this education system look and feel and have outcomes that are very different from what we've seen in past. How hopeful are you that we can really get there?
I'm extremely hopeful, very optimistic. The Strive High accountability system we have is of huge import in what happens in Hawaii. Even all of our charter schools have to follow this accountability system, which, again, if the accountability system is going to drive what happens in the classroom, then you have to be very thoughtful about what's going to be part of this accountability system. And so I think this is the opportunity. What the governor is looking at and what the ESSA team is looking at, and we've talked about this from the beginning, that what if we looked at accountability in terms of let's comply with what the feds want us to do, but then why can't we also think of a separate accountability system for ourselves, which we feel are more important to what we want to see happen in Hawaii? So although some people may think, what are you talking about? I think there are many instances where we do what we need to do to comply and provide that information to the federal government. But if that's not meaningful for what we want and what's important in Hawaii, we should then create our own accountability system that drives what we actually want to see happen in our classrooms and in our schools. So it's a little bit more work to do, but again, it'll probably yield a whole lot more of the results that we want to see happen.
If you're just joining us today on Town Square, we're taking a look at the ESSA, the Every Student Succeeds Act, looking at it in more depth than we have been able to in some of the conversations that we've had on the morning show on The Conversation, and wondering how you are assessing this change. If you have children in school and looking at this year and having perhaps been told that this is the bridge year to some changes coming down in the school year of 17-18, and looking at what this means for you, your family, your kids, and what this also means for Hawaii as we go forward and hopefully educate a workforce that we're going to need in not too long from now for jobs that may not even exist yet, as we've talked about, that, you know, maybe using technology that's not invented yet, all kinds of things that are unknowns, but certain skills and ways of being that would be able to meet those challenges because of the way a child is taught, not necessarily just what a child is taught. I'm watching Amy Peruso nod at me at all of that. As you're looking at this now, mm-hmm. I mean, you're a classroom teacher. You're also a mom.
Right.
And so this hits you on two different fronts.
Right. So I think that I was just thinking about the importance of the Strive High accountability system, but also thinking about the ways in which we have been constrained, and the systems that have kept teaching and learning in classrooms in Hawaii in this very narrow range, right? And so really rigidified what's happening in a classroom. And I think that part of the change I think that's already happening has to do with the role of test scores. And I really think that the delinkage of test scores from teacher evaluations is going to allow teachers to have more freedom in the classroom, take risks, be innovative. I think that's so incredibly important. But on the other hand, I think that the principals still have that test scores are linked to their evaluations, really, in their contract. So if the principals are still driven by the role that test scores are playing in their evaluation, then they will in turn be driving the school in a direction that is really around test scores. And when I think about my daughter's education, that makes me a little apprehensive, because I think that there's a possibility for change that won't be taken advantage of unless that change happens.
Which seems to be part of, you know, your concern, Jim, in looking at, well, if we're really going to say that it's important that children have certain experiences, like whether it's the symphony or whether it's the science fair or something that certainly has a lot to do with a child's learning, and we don't give credit for that, that in ways doesn't give credence to it either. It makes it seem as if it's not learning.
Well, it's even more fundamental. You know, students are really, in terms of assessments, not encouraged to work together. Mm-hmm. Students are evaluated individually. If students work together and shared their work on a test, we would call that cheating. But that is what almost every adult group employer university wants to see, the ability of students to work together. It's not that we don't know how. On a sports team, you work together. In a band or an orchestra or a jazz group, you work together. In all these other things. But these are not counted as that important. You know, until we go to the part where part of graduation is being part of a team that's evaluated as a team, maybe not everything, but a small part of this to encourage it. It's a lot easier, you know, when you're in an elementary situation, one teacher is kind of weaving it all together. But once you get to middle school and high school, I teach math, you teach social studies, we're not in the same tribe, right? Collaborating with each other takes extra effort. You know, the robotics team is after school. So part of this has to do with time, too, the bell schedule. As I think someone mentioned earlier, maybe yourself, you know, 42 minutes and out. Nobody does anything collaboratively well, in depth, in 42 minutes and out, right? And this is structured for the convenience of adults and administering it. Until we integrate these into the very fabric of how we think about a school, I don't see where we're going to make that much progress. But I think this is the opportunity. This is the chance to put that on the table and go to the Board of Ed and say, hey, we want you to make some basic reforms, risk-taking. You know, you don't achieve anything if you don't fail once in a while and learn from it. If everything is polishing the apple so that you don't fail, this isn't education.
And it's not representative of what happens in life.
That's right.
Very often we're told you're going to hear no more than you're going to hear yes. You better get used to it and understand how to move through it. But we don't really teach kids for that. And we have situations where everybody wins and everybody gets a medal and everybody is doing fine, to where we don't understand that competition can be good and healthy, and how we do that in a collaborative model, for example, with robotics and other teams, is an essential part of what many people are going to find as part of their work lives when they get to the point where they have one. Tonight on Town Square, or today on Town Square, we're talking about the ESSA, the Every Student Succeeds Act, and what changes it's bringing and what changes some of the people around this table would like to see. What changes would you like to see? You guys are pretty quiet tonight. Is that because you don't really believe that this change is something that's helpful or that can happen, or you've heard all this kind of stuff before and it's just going to be one more thing that you think you're going to sail through or move past? Sometimes teachers have told us that, you know, we're just going to ride it out. Mm-hmm. We're going to just see what's going to happen with this. But it's one more thing that's come down either from the state or from the feds. And even though there are certain federal mandates with the ESSA, as there were with No Child Left Behind, since, you know, Strive High is already meeting a lot of those, I'm wondering, you know, how, when you talk to other teachers, Amy, how they're assessing some of this in terms of a great opportunity or something else that they're going to have to just hop to and meet.
I think that it's a matter of building trust over time, and I think that this process of engagement is going to be really critical, because I do think that there's been so much overuse of the term collaboration with respect to teachers and getting their input, and we'll do a joint committee, and it doesn't really feel joint.
So it's become sort of meaningless?
Right. And also, I think that teachers, from my perspective, in my limited experience, feel a little bit cynical, right? So this is going to be a challenge to help them understand the possibilities.
And I'm wondering if parents out there and other teachers who may be listening may also be feeling that sense of cynicism. We want to hear from you. 941-3689 is our number, 941-3689. or 877-941-3689. A lot of people see the ESSA as being a really incredible opportunity. Others, as we say, are looking at it as just one more thing that's come down the pike. We want to hear what you have to say about it. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Jim Shawn, as you look at this from the perspective of an educator, former lawmaker, do lawmakers understand all of this really well enough to be able to make an assessment when it comes time to make appropriations or to understand how the DOE may need to change?
No. some do. You know, there's a tremendous amount of information that flows through the ledge, right? And we sometimes don't appreciate how much does flow through it, right? But in many ways, the inner world of the DOE or of a school or a charter is really far from the perch that legislators and others sit on. This last session, for example, unbelievably, somebody thought, let's move the College of Ed out to West Oahu and, without knowing, eliminate 750 graduate students and on, right? They could not have done that if they were very well informed and did their homework. And I personally am really disappointed of how few bothered to show up and join the 1,019 at the forum, you know. But we are in some ways talking about bringing democracy to the school. Empowerment is a democratic idea, right? And so the usual power structures, all due respect to teachers and the principals and others, right? They've always had a certain amount of power. But the only group that represents all the stakeholders at a school in the DOE is the school community councils, or in the charters, their governing board, right? It's a kind of stakeholder community. Students even sit on it, right? That group is explicitly prohibited from being a decision maker in the DOE, right? Now, it seems to me if we are serious, we have got to say, okay, you guys are going to be able to make these decisions now. You're going to mess up sometimes. You're going to go down a route that you've got to, oh, turn around, that didn't work, whatever, right? It's harder to work with a group in a collaborative way. But that's what empowerment means, and that's where the teachers are going to, oh, I now have the right to decide the curriculum in a much greater way. Mm-hmm. And that buy-in, that ownership, I think many people have said, that's what's missing. It's all you know, you don't respect me if I have to ask five people permission to spend this little extra flexible money.
Jim, it seems like we've been down this path before. I mean, way back when, remember the school community-based management idea, which had the same kind of, you know, basis behind it of let's let schools and in their communities be directed by those who are there on the ground, aside from just charter schools. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to be, in many ways, as soft and toothless as you say that the school community councils are.
But I think No Child Left Behind cut that off, you know, at the knees, right? And you had to make AYP adequate yearly progress. You had to do testing. Oh, what if we don't make it? The entire community got upset if we didn't have our test scores. I think the education committee went, you know, bought into it too much and gave it too much credence as well, you know. And so the education of the whole child, in so many elementary schools, we heard again and again, nobody's teaching science. They're hardly teaching social studies, you know, the arts. We are prepping those third graders for the math and the language test. You know, we went too far as an educational community, farther than we needed to, right? And so I think there are explanations why the initial efforts at CBM, you know, died, right? But we've fought our way back now. We've got waivers. But this is an opportunity as the governor is marching through the Board of Ed with new appointees, with new ideas, with new commitments to this. Daryl's very much involved in these, you know, conversations. There is an opportunity for them to see a new vision.
All right. You also have an opportunity to get involved with this conversation. If you're a family, a teacher, this is going to affect you, and really, how are you assessing the ESSA and what the possibilities may be versus what you've seen in past. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Tony calling us from Kona. Aloha, Tony. Thank you for your patience.
Hi there.
Hi.
I appreciate what the gentleman was just saying. A lot of major points I wanted to make myself. Speaking, just one comment, the school community council, I believe the problem with that, I am on my school community council, and the ultimate power still lies with the principal. They have ultimate veto power. So you can have a school community council, well, like ours, with two teacher reps and community reps, and all power members at the school are there at the table. But the ultimate decision is still at the hands of the principal. So that's one thing I wanted to say. That's kind of a problem I know with our system here with the school community council. The other is my concern, and a lot of teachers I know are leaving the profession because of the Common Core and concern about appropriateness and curriculum cognitively appropriate and developmentally appropriate. So those are issues that I know a lot of teachers are concerned about.
All right, Tony. Thanks very much for calling with us.
Thank you.
Good to have you join the conversation. So I'm watching Amy, and who wants to just take, she's just chomping at the bit here to give you an answer. So the idea that a principal, you know, is head of the tribe and has veto power, regardless of what everybody may want to have in a school, is nothing new. I mean, certainly we've seen that been the driver for quite a long time. Do you have anything in what you have experienced or what came out of this summit or what in general you've been speaking to other teachers and principals, too, that would change that would make that truly more collaborative and give the school community councils more of a say in this that would be based in reality and not just a nice idea?
Well, I think that it is a matter of going back to the history of the gutting of the school community-based management system and looking at the policies that were changed and reinstating language that makes that community control, that teacher voice more powerful in that organization, in that structure. I do think that it's really important. And when we talk about school empowerment, I know that Daryl and I have had a lot of discussions about what that means, because for teachers to be creative, to be innovative, to be risk takers, we have to feel empowered. And I really think that some of the best principals I've worked with have been those that just let teachers fly and let them be creative, because it models that for their students. And it creates a really exciting learning environment.
That also, you know, the subtext of that is you have to be willing to let somebody fail.
Right. And actually that requires on the part of the principal also a willingness to take risk and to say we embrace failure, because as Jim was saying, you have to have failure at some level if you're doing anything meaningful. If you're trying something different, you have to accept that there's going to be some level of failure at some points. I think the other point I wanted to address was
about the Common Core.
Yeah, that Tony's point about Common Core. ESSA does allow us to develop our own standards. And as a social studies teacher, I'm currently involved in rewriting our state social studies content standards. And I think that it's really powerful. It's really exciting, and it's important for teachers to do that work. Not external experts who are not in the classroom. Not consultants.
That's what I heard you say. All right, 941-3689 is our number if you call us from Oahu and from the neighbor islands, or if you're listening to the live stream someplace else and want to get in on this conversation, our number is 877-941-3689. As we look at Hawaii's education system, has been taking it on the chin for a long time. Very often we don't necessarily celebrate some of the good things about it. We talk a lot about what's wrong with it. But as we now move into this era of the Every Student Succeeds Act replacing No Child Left Behind and the opportunity that that presents, how confident are you that Hawaii can really maximize the possibilities, whether you're a teacher or a parent, a principal, an educator, a community member, lawmaker? We want to hear from you. 941-3689-877-941-3689. Going to James calling us from Captain Cook. Aloha, James. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi. Can you hear me?
We can.
Hi. I'm a fairly recently retired teacher from Kona. I appreciate the comments of the last three speakers, including my esteemed former colleague, Tony. I'm very hopeful that if we can live up to the motto of every student succeeds, there are tremendous possibilities. But in order to achieve that, we're going to have to let go of the standards model, the factory model, the business orientation, the schooling. We're going to have to redefine success in terms of the child. Maybe not every child is going to do well at everything, but why don't we emphasize finding the unique strengths and abilities of every child and developing them? Let's put the visionaries in charge and take the corporations and profit motive out of our schools.
All right, James, thanks very much for calling us with your comment.
Okay.
All right, we're going to talk about that a little bit, because if we look back to our history and see how it moved from the one-room schoolhouse, the education system, that is, into what we now know as being standard education, where we have different periods of the day that kids go through, going from one subject to another, to another, to another, and really being able to put fences around those subjects and not seeing the curriculum integrate in a way that life does, that we have been doing a disservice to kids. But that, again, was, as he called it, the factory model. If we're going to redefine what educational success means and what the system is to teach to that, it's going to be an educational experience, truly, for everybody. There are a lot of parents who are very concerned that their kids are not going to come out knowing how to read properly, knowing how to be able to have critical thinking skills, to be able to know science, know history. But again, looking at it from a subject-by-subject matter, as opposed to, for example, some of the schools where you see, again, looking at a high-tech high, how that's all integrated into one curriculum where kids learn this in the process of learning, not necessarily because they're being made to simply understand and regurgitate facts and figures. How would you redefine success, and how would you see us going to that place, Daryl, as you've been spending so much of your time working on the ESSA, but you've spent a lot of your life as an educator, a principal in high school, and seeing how kids move in that age group in particular. How do we get to this redefined area of success if you had your druthers?
I think we've moved to the far end of the spectrum in terms of looking at test scores and testing metrics, but for teachers, and I'm a former social studies teacher like Amy, we've always looked at the whole child and looked at test scores as just being one small piece of what you have to actually understand for what happens with learning. I think we have to first make a decision about there is a value in testing and using test scores, but we have to make a very thoughtful decision immediately about what that value is, and to set that down next to a core value about how we will run the rest of our system.
What's that value to you?
One of the values we have to have is this idea of we have to have a trust system. We have to be able to, first of all, create and provide the system to create the best teachers that we possibly can and create the best school leaders that we can, and then we need to trust them. Some people have talked to me about empowerment and have shared their concerns about it's going to be chaos and there'll be lots of problems. And empowerment is not a simple thing. It's where we just say, just empower everybody. Leadership is huge about this, and trusting our teachers is huge. But all those pieces have to be aligned. The system has to be aligned in order for this to happen. We can't have a system that believes in compliance and in command and control, and then at the same time say, we already empower you,
makes it sound empty.
Yes. So I think the teachers, if we stop and we listen to our teachers in the classroom, we have amazing teachers and we have some great principals. And if we listen to their voices, they can really help to guide where we need to go and how we need to make this all happen.
Jim, come back into the conversation. As you listen to Daryl talk about values and really trying to get a good handle on what we value and aligning all of those all the way through the both the system and the curriculum. What's a start for that? What begins to develop that sense of trust?
Well, I have some crazy ideas of what would push a school towards that. You know, supposing you took one day out of the week and you said, this day is devoted to multi-age, multidisciplinary projects. And the school, in choosing its projects, should also come up with authentic ways of evaluating student learning in these project multidisciplinary, multi-age projects.
Right? So give me an example of what that project might be.
Well, I mean, you know, let's just say something that's already out there, like robotics, right? Well, it only happens after school, right? Lots of science, lots of service learning and social studies projects you could do. A lot of things with the arts. Kids get together with poor kids and do a mural. Whatever those kind, I mean, there are many possibilities. But the notion that you're not going to march through the factory day every day, and you want students to be engaged in something that lasts a long time. I had a very good friend who was a good artist, and he was working with Hale Kipa and other troubled youths doing art. And these students got together, and they did a mural. Mm-hmm. And they also did little art projects. These were the first projects these students ever did mm-hmm. that they ever completed, mm-hmm. right? And there's this whole notion of completing something over time. Having been a judge at the science fair, I see students who started in the ninth grade. By the 12th grade, what they know about that project, right, is challenging the UH guys who are evaluating them. Their jaws are dropping. You're mapping the human brain. You're correcting the NASA calculations for, you know, meteors. And they're actually doing this, right? This is a long-term learning engagement involvement, right, that we are not able to do. So my interesting sort of example, what if one day combine all these interesting ideas? You can do all your other stuff the other 4 days, right? And there are actually some charter schools that do this, right? That entire Friday or whatever it is, it's all project-based learning, authentic. You know, in Hawaiian, it's ho'oike. You're demonstrating your capability. It's a wonderful overlap with our Hawaiian traditions. If we just did that, think of the ripples of change that would have to happen in the school and in the system and in letting go to do this.
We're going to take some callers now, but just hearing you describe some of that, I mean, that sounds a little bit like Waldorf education, or in some ways like Montessori education. You can sort of pick and choose some of those aspects of it, but the idea that it's not just moving from class to class, period to period.
Maybe
to period.
It's Ige education.
Maybe it's Ige education. I think he'd like to hear that. But we'd like to hear from you, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. As we look at this next school year, which is starting pretty soon, folks, just another, week and a half or so before we'll be into another school year. If you're a teacher, if you're a parent, an educator, a school member of any sort, if you are a community member, a lawmaker, everyone who has been engaged in looking at Hawaii's education system and how to make it better. How do you see it happening through the ESSA? After you've just listened to Jim Shawn talk about some of his vision, Daryl Galera is here, Amy Peruso, and you too. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Kathy calling from Kauai. Aloha, Kathy. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi, I'm going to pull over on the side of the road right here.
Good idea. We would like to have you know or know that you're talking to us safely.
Yeah. So I am a teacher at a high school, and in retrospect, looking backwards at what NCLB has done with regard to how teachers teach, how administrators govern, there's so much damage in terms of how backwards you've gone in terms of assessment, in terms of teaching, curriculum, the whole ball of wax. And it always, you know, like that lady prior always says, it starts with the principal. Now, I've been a longtime advocate that administrators often forget what it is like for a teacher to be under the constraints of specific limitations with regard to NCLB, all that comes out of the legislature. So in the last few years under NCLB,
Kathy, excuse me. I want to interrupt you for a second because we're losing you a little bit. Make sure you talk right into your mouthpiece so that we can hear what you have to say.
Okay.
Thanks.
So the constraints of annual yearly progress has really, really, really affected what and how teachers have changed their curriculum. And to undo that the horrendous stress of getting those numbers, getting those scores, making sure we don't fall into the red, it's changed teachers and how we understand and look at why we do the things we do.
So, Kathy, as you look at the ESSA, do you think that is a new opportunity and that everything that you say has, you know, slid backwards during No Child Left Behind? Do you think that it's possible to move in the new direction despite the lack of trust and despite what you say has just happened with some of your fellow teachers under No Child Left Behind?
I absolutely do think that it is very possible. Here's the thing is that as a high school teacher, I see these kids for 4 years. We have them for 4 years. And it takes so long for this system to change that this generation, these 4 years, these kids who will leave us in the next 4 years, the 9th to 12th graders, they're going to lose out big time. And it happens every time we change a system thinking it's going to be better this way. And I'm a teacher of 38 years now, so I have really seen the gamut of what the quote-unquote experts can do to damage a system.
Okay. We're going to leave it there for a moment because you seem to be making a point that we talked about a little earlier that with so much that has happened over time, and she mentioned that she's been teaching for 38 years, you know, there have been a lot of movements that have come down the pike, you know, locally here, for everything from the Success Compact, the No Child Left Behind. I mean, you can just chuck them in there, plus, you know, the various ones that happened within the state and then and federally, too. And yet she says that she's hopeful, but that there's going to have to be a real shift or a movement. Daryl, is that going to be possible, you think, for principals to be able to understand that this can't just be a top-down situation anymore if we're really going to move in that direction? And you talk about aligning all those values that you mentioned earlier. Are principals going to be able to move in that direction, or are we going to see a lot of, you know, outflow as some, and maybe a lot, aren't able to do that?
You know, Beth, let me make a couple of points here. That we have, you know, 280 school principals across the state, and so the principals that have only been a principal for the past 5 years, all they know in terms of being a principal and how to lead a school is what they've experienced in the past 5 years. That's a concern to me. Principals who have been in the system for a longer time, they have seen the opportunities where they could be innovative and creative and take risks and try different things to move their schools forward. So they would embrace and welcome the opportunity to be a leader and not a manager. So that's a really interesting thing that we have to take a look at, be very thoughtful about looking at our current body of school principals in terms of how we need to support them. And as we move forward and we create this new blueprint, how we need to make sure we implement this. And again, it's not just put some words on a paper and make it move forward. The other piece that we've talked about on the ESSA team, and we shared this at the summit, is that it would be inspiring for us as a state to become, as a system, to ourselves become, you know, focused on research and design and to be a self-correcting education system, our own think tank, if you want. So we are actually checking ourselves. So if something like an NCLB came down the line again, we would catch ourselves and we would be able to be more thoughtful about, okay, wait a minute, instead of just jumping in and complying with everything, that we would remember what we know, what the research says, and what we need to do in terms of pedagogy, in terms of instruction and assessment, because we know what those best practices are and how to maximize learning. But again, if we let the policy people who might make not a great decision guide us, if we have a system that can catch that and correct that, I think that would be a very inspiring type of way to move forward.
You bring up the issue of the disconnect between pedagogical understanding and a lot of consultants and policymakers who don't necessarily understand that, and trying to build in some sort of, I want to call it a fail-safe, but at least some sort of catch or a check to be able to see that that doesn't happen, so this huge backsliding doesn't happen once again. For those of you listening, how might that happen? How would you see that kind of change happen in your school? If we're looking at this community by community, if you're in a charter school, if you're in a regular DOE school, how would you see that happen, particularly if you are a teacher or parent, longtime parent in a school? What might you want to see as part of this idea of catching ourselves before we could backslide again, as many teachers and parents and other educators and lawmakers and community members have said we've done under No Child Left Behind, now that there's a new chance under the ESSA, the Every Student Succeeds Act? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. I promise we're going to take some callers now. Paul, calling us from Maui, thanks very much for your patience.
Aloha. I have been a teacher in Connecticut and in Hawaii. I call it going from the sublime to the ridiculous. Hawaii's system is one of the worst that I've ever seen. It's the only system that's a statewide system, and I would advocate that we get rid of the state DOE completely and that we go to Maui running its own school system and all the other islands running their own school systems, going back to local school systems. I also feel very strongly about the fact that education is the only profession where the further away you get from the primary task, the higher up you go. For example, we have a superintendent who's never been before, never taught in a classroom. That is a travesty. No superintendent should ever be anything but a former teacher. We do not honor our teachers the way we should. We don't pay what they should be paid, and we don't support our schools. And finally, the last point I want to make is the importance of arts education in schools. When I was in Connecticut, we had all the arts all the time. In Hawaii, where the arts are so much part of the culture, we have none of the arts none of the time. And I'll take my comments off the air.
All right, Paul, you hit a lot of nerves around this table. I just could feel it. It's palpable. Stay with us. And for those of you listening, if you want to get in on this conversation, call us now, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We've heard from a lot of teachers tonight. I'd like to hear from some parents and other community members, too. But if you're a teacher, please don't feel that's telling you not to call. But really trying to get a sense of how people are assessing the ESSA early in the process, as we're looking to see how Hawaii's school system will be changing. Jim Sean, I know you wanted to answer Paul.
Yeah, some people think that to integrate the arts is expensive. Well, I'm aware of many schools that do a lot of it. Just one that I have been involved with in the past is the Lab School, where every student over time takes a wide range of visual arts, of painting, of textiles, of pottery. Everybody has to participate in performance arts. And they do this within the regular hours of the school day with less money than the DOE schools. They have made it a priority. And the interesting thing is that students are selected to reflect the socioeconomic profile of the entire state, because they do curriculum development there, right? So this is not all rich kids or whatever, right? Those students, by having a holistic education, the school pays very little attention to test prep, and they all do great on the tests, right? It's an example of, it's not necessarily money. It's not necessarily money. It is theory. It is commitment to the whole child and understanding, as the former speaker called. We got a lot of Neighbor Island folks calling in. That individual suggested is that if you are involved with the arts and expressing yourselves and finding something that's within you, you tend to do better. And there are studies, particularly for instrumental music, that show over time, instrumental music has an incredible impact on lower socioeconomic kids and their achievement in other academic areas.
All right, we're going to take one of those. You mentioned that we got a lot of callers from the Neighbor Islands. Now we've got one from Honolulu. And if you'd like to be next, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Joe, calling us from Honolulu. Aloha, Joe. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi, aloha. I'm a member of a charter school board, and we have three public conversion charter schools that we govern. About a year and a half ago, I attended the first session that the Educational Institute of Hawaii put on. And since then, we've been moving toward this empowerment model. And I just wanted to comment real quickly on how that worked for us. So, Daryl, thank you very much. I think your comments about trust are just spot on. We absolutely trust our teachers and our principals to develop curriculums along with the budgets at the same time for each of the communities that we serve. So we serve three very diverse communities and very diverse student bodies as well. So there was never a time where we felt like a top-down model was the best way to go. So we've adopted a real empowerment model. We've allowed our principals and teachers to be part of the budgeting process and the curriculum building process. And I think we're going to start seeing some real fruits from that trust that we've given our teachers and principals.
Joe,
thank you very much.
Joe,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Hang on a second. I mean, you're saying you think you're going to be able to see some of the fruit of all of that work. That's really where you're going to know how truly empowered, you know, your organization, your school really is.
That's very true. So,
we're going to have to wait and see on that one. But it looks like it's been set up to where you might have a chance to be able to do that. And we hope that you do and that you'll call us back and let us know how that's going. Thanks very much for calling us tonight. Going now to Robert calling us from Maui. Aloha, Robert. Welcome to Town Square.
Mahalo. I'm a retired school administrator, and I haven't heard any school administrators on your program, so I thought I would call in.
Well, thank you.
Because I think that we have an important voice, and I think that, you know, my initial thoughts are that I'd be more than happy to empower other people as long as I could put their responsibility, make it shared, and let's just say that everybody's on the same playing field. And if you perform, you're rewarded. If you don't perform, you're gone. As a school administrator, that's how it works. That's how it worked with us.
All right. Thanks. Thank you very much for that, because I want to talk a little bit before we have to say goodbye about that. Amy, I mean, you've heard this for a long time, too. I'm sure that there are principals who say, but I don't have any control over this. Mm-hmm. I can't get rid of some of these teachers who are not performing. How do you create a meritocracy in a school system and reward that and have shared responsibility with both the, you know, administration and the teachers when, you know, a principal feels that he or she doesn't really have any control over some of the teachers who may not be performing to standard?
Well, I think that's a multi-layered question. And I think the first issue is that I'm not sure that we would want a meritocracy in schools. I don't think that it's necessarily healthy in schools to have teachers competing against each other or to create a kind of hierarchy amongst teachers. I haven't seen that to be a productive model. But I think actually it doesn't speak to the reality of Hawaii public schools, because we have a teacher shortage crisis. So we can't even get teachers in the classroom. We will have tens of thousands of students come fall that will not have a licensed and certified teacher in front of them. So I think, and there's a reason for that. Nobody wants to be a teacher. And we have to first address the reasons for that. So it's about respect, it's about pay, it's about empowerment. And until those things happen, I think the question of how you would get rid of teachers is really the wrong question to be asking. We should be asking, how do we keep teachers? How do we grow teachers? How do we make them stronger?
Daryl.
The culture of the school is the most important part of the organization. And I think when a school principal, when a leader understands that it's not about looking at who I'm going to fire, who I need to get rid of, but understanding that I need to build this positive culture that's going to support teachers, support students, supports everyone there, and create this learning organization that is just an empowering system. That's when you will have high-performing schools, and it's not about, just figuring out who to fire. It's about how to support and having teachers continually rise up to levels of excellence.
We often hear that this isn't about how much money you're going to throw at this, but I clearly hear you talking about teachers being paid more and teachers being valued more by being paid more, and you're all nodding at me. What is it about that part of it that we seem not to be able to get our minds around, Jim, as you look at the system which you've been studying for such a long time?
Well, I think when you continue to fund the same structure, everybody gets frustrated. And the funders then say, well, do you really deserve this extra money because the test scores aren't going up, because that's how we judge success, two test scores. And it's kind of a vicious circle. I did want to mention something that relates to the school culture. And you're talking about a high school, and we're all saying, oh, yeah, it's all about the kids. You know, mostly it's all about what we're going to do to or for the kids, not with them. Mm. In what areas of their education are we giving them any authority to do anything? You know, there's some schools where we talk about projects. The students come up with a project and a budget, and they have to present it to the entire school body and get them to vote to say, yes, we think your budget is good and your project is good. There's even in math, students can be involved in the finances of a school and calculating them, right? In running the school, when you get into the upper grades, why is it that the students are the object of our leadership and not the partners in our leadership? And, you know, and they come out of high school and they, you know, it's another 4 years at least before anyone gives them any respect as a young person, right? We want them to be voters. They can go in the military. Are we giving them, you know, their own empowerment and engagement? And, yeah, okay, you want to paint this side of the building polka dot, go ahead. It's your choice, even though I don't like polka dot, you know.
All right, well, we've got just about a minute before we have to say goodbye. But, I mean, clearly your point being made, there has to be a lot more to be able to enrich a full child and not just keep them segmented and fragmented, because that's not what human beings are all about. I want to thank all of you for being here. That sounds almost like, that should be a promo for the film, Most Likely to Succeed. Also, the book of the same name. I know you like that one, too. And Daryl Galera, you like that as well. Thanks so much to Amy Peruso from HSTA and Daryl Galera from the Governor's ESSA team, and Jim Shawn, the director of the Education Policy Institute. And you, too, for joining us for Town Square. We'll be back next week, and I'll see you tomorrow morning right here at 8 o'clock for The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Aloha.